Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Monday, March 22nd. I'm your reader, Bob Young. Today we can expect a cloudy day with a touch of wind. The high will be 57 degrees with light winds from the east-southeast, and tonight we go down to 48 degrees, and again overcast with a little bit of rain possible, winds from 7 to 14 miles per hour. As we look around the region, we see cloudy today with a touch of rain, overcast and mild tonight with a bit of rain again, rain tomorrow, breezy in the afternoon, Wednesday remaining cloudy and breezy in the afternoon. Sunrise this morning was at 7:09 a.m. and it sets tonight at 7:24 p.m. and our next moon phase is full moon on March 28. The lead stories on the front page today include Austin speaks of war's end, Biden faces border challenge, Reynolds calls April meat month, and we will begin with pandemic left many in debt, you can get out from under. Amy Rivers filed this story. Waterloo. If you're stuck underneath a pile of credit card debt after a year unlike any other, you're far from alone. The pandemic has had a major impact on their financial situation, 17% of Americans say, while another 26% said it had at least a minor impact, according to a recent poll done by the Associated Press and NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. That meant holiday spending in December was put on credit cards more than ever, according to LendEDU, an online financial marketplace geared toward college students. That organization surveyed Americans in December and found 74% said they had too much credit card debt. That number jumped when those surveyed had been laid off in 2020, 80%, or were still out of work, 86%. Quote, I would say credit card debt is the worst debt you can have, said Mike Finley, a Waterloo man who retired at 45 years old and gives out financial advice as the crazy man in the pink wig. Quote, that compounding of fees can dramatically increase the amount of debt you have over time, unquote. It's the high interest rates the cards can charge, higher than a mortgage or most car payments, that make credit card debt so tough to get out from under. Quote, we do see more credit card debt than other types of debt, said Karen Rondo, director of counseling operations with Consumer Credit Counseling Service, which has an office in Waterloo. Quote, after your holiday bills come in and it's tax time, people are really looking at how they can start to pay down their unsecured debt. Here is the advice from Findlay and Rondo. Make a budget, particularly if you're not sure how much you're spending month to month. Quote, it's eye-opening in that regard when they're able to create a budget and maintain it month after month, Rondo said. You get a good sense of what's going in and out, unquote. Some people have taken pandemic buying to an extreme, like compulsively scrolling Amazon, Findlay said, and if you're one of them, it's important to be honest with yourself about your wants versus needs. Quote, some of it's psychological. Many people buy things almost as a security blanket, he said, but credit card debt lasts a long time, unquote. See if you can use a pandemic-era program like mortgage and student loan deferment, or even the extra $300 per week in unemployment through September, and dedicate that money to go toward credit card debt. Quote, when COVID first hit, creditors, student loans, mortgage lenders, they put forbearances and deferments on their products, so that helped out our typical clients when they would otherwise be struggling, Rondo said. Findlay added that the recent stimulus check is a great candidate for applying toward credit card debt, even though it might not be the most fun way to spend it. It's the mindset. I want to get rid of this. It's killing me, Findlay said. You do have to be motivated to do it. If you're still having trouble, book time with a nonprofit credit counselor who can help you put a plan together to get the debt paid off within a few years at lower payment amounts per month. But don't fall prey to debt consolidation scams that charge high fees. Reach out before you start falling behind, Rondo said. If you're just making those minimum payments, your balances are not going down, you're accruing late fees. That's the ideal time to reach out. There may be more options at that point that the counselor could look at, unquote. And if you're out of work, lost hours at work, or are remote working, use that extra time to not just get out of debt, but start learning how to make your money work for you, Findley said. Quote, for those who really do want to get in control of their finances, they have this extra bit of time to use to formulate a plan, he said. That's what everybody needs, unquote. Reynolds declares April Meat on the Table Month, filed by James Lynch, and begins with a photograph of Governor Kim Reynolds speaking behind a podium. Fire up the grill. The meat war is on. Governor Kim Reynolds has declared April, quote, Meat on the Table Month to promote the Iowa meat producers' meat packaged with wholesome and nutritious protein that play a critical role in combating hunger and fighting food insecurity throughout Iowa, America, and around the globe, unquote. Reynolds' proclamation signed Friday comes in response to a Meat Out proclamation by Democratic Colorado Governor Jason Polis. The proclamation produced a beefy debate with 26 Colorado counties proclaiming Meat Day to show their support for meat producers. Quote, Iowa feeds the world with high-quality products, Reynolds said in her proclamation. Pork, beef, lamb, poultry, and fish production generated almost $29 billion in crop and livestock sales, making Iowa the second leading agricultural state in the nation, she stated. Across the Missouri River, Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts, also a Republican, declared Beef Month to highlight the cattle industry there. Started in 1985 by the Farm Animal Rights Movement, the Meat Out proclamations have been issued by state and national authorities around the world. The nonprofit group started Meat Out Day, generally on March 20th, to encourage people to explore the benefits on a wholesome plant-based diet. It cited lower risk of high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, various cancers, and diabetes as benefits of a meatless diet. Meat production, according to some environmentalists, increases the carbon footprint of food production and diminishes forests, grasslands, and wildlife habitat. The anti-meat movement recently received a boost from Bill Gates's comments about producing synthetic meat as an alternative to livestock production. Meat producers are under constant scrutiny from, quote, ill-informed politicians and social media influencers, Reynolds said in her proclamation. They mislead consumers and disregard sound research supporting the quality and safety of animal agricultural production, she said. More than ever, the governor said, quote, it is imperative that agricultural leaders unite and stand up for our industry, the products and the people who produce and process meat that feeds an ever-growing world population. Meat plays a large role in Iowa agricultural and the state's economy. According to a 2019 Agricultural Economic Contribution Study, Iowa farms helped raise approximately 4 million cattle and calves, almost 1 million beef cows, 224,000 dairy cows, and 23 million hogs and pigs. That production, in turn, helped support Iowa crop farms, which made Iowa the nation's top producer of corn and the number two producer of soybeans behind Illinois. Iowa farmers produced 2.6 billion bushels of corn and nearly 554 million bushels of soybeans. Based on the USDA's 2017 Census of Agriculture, 30% of Iowans are employed by ag and ag-related industries, contributing to $40 billion in value-added agriculture, $22 billion in wages, and $121 billion in total agricultural sales. Biden faces challenges on the border, filed by Jonathan Lemire of the Associated Press, and the story begins with a photograph of young people resting on blankets on the ground with the caption under the picture, Migrants rest in a gazebo at a park after a large group of deportees were pushed by Mexican authorities off an area where they had been staying after their expulsion from the U.S. on Saturday in Reynosa, Mexico. Washington. The Biden administration is scrambling to manage a growing humanitarian and political challenge at the U.S.-Mexico border that threatens to overshadow its ambitious legislative agenda. With the number of migrants surging, administration officials say Biden inherited an untenable situation that resulted from what they say was President Donald Trump's undermining and weakening of the immigration system. But as Congress pivots to immigration legislation, stories of unaccompanied minors and families trying to cross the border and seek asylum, and of overwhelmed border facilities have begun to dominate the headlines, distracting from the White House's efforts to promote the recently passed $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill. Biden told reporters Sunday at the White House that, quote, at some point, he would go to the border and that he knows what is going on in the border facilities. Quote, a lot more. We are in the process of doing it now, including making sure we reestablish what existed before, which was they can stay in place and make their case from their home countries, Biden said upon returning from a weekend at Camp David. The White House dispatched Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to 4 Sunday news shows in an effort to stress that it was working to get things under control. Quote, our mission has been straightforward. The border is closed, Mayorkas said. Quote, we are expelling families. We are expelling single adults, and we've made a decision that we will not expel young, vulnerable children, unquote. The White House has steadfastly refused to call the situation a crisis, leading to a Washington battle over the appropriate description of the tense situation. Career immigration officials have warned there could be a surge after the November election, and the news that Trump's hardline policies were being reversed. In the first days of his term, Biden acted to undo some of Trump's measures, a rollback interpreted by some as a signal to travel to the United States. While the new administration was working on immigration legislation to address long-term problems, it didn't have the on-the-ground plan to manage a surge of migrants. Quote, we have seen large numbers of migration in the past. We know how to address it. We have a plan. We're executing on our plan, and we will succeed, Mayorkas said. But, he added, it takes time, and the situation is especially challenging and difficult now because of the Trump administration's moves. So we are rebuilding the system as we address the needs of vulnerable children who arrive at our borders. Biden officials have done away with the kids in cages imagery that defined the Trump family separation policy, though Trump used facilities built during the Obama administration, but have struggled with creating the needed capacity to deal with the surge. Unaccompanied children and teenagers in Customs and Border Protection custody must be transferred to the care of Health and Human Services within 3 days, although the minors coming now are being held for days longer than that. Officials are trying to build up capacity to care for some 14,000 migrants now in federal custody, and more likely on the way. Critics say the administration should have been better prepared. Quote, I haven't seen a plan, said Representative Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas. Quote, they have created a humanitarian crisis down here at this border that you have seen now. And the reason why they are coming is because he says words do matter, and they do. The messaging is that if you want to come, you can stay, unquote. The administration also has been pressed as to why it will not allow media to see the facilities at the border. Mayorkas said the government was, quote, working on providing access so that individuals will be able to see what the conditions in the Border Patrol stations are like. Since Biden's inauguration on January 20th, the U.S. has seen a dramatic spike in the number of people encountered by border officials. There are 18,945 family members and 9,297 unaccompanied children encountered in February, an increase of 168% and 63% respectively from the month before, according to the Pew Research Center. That creates an enormous logistical challenge because children in particular require higher standards of care and coordination across agencies. Among the reasons for the surge, thousands of Central American migrants already stuck at the border for months, and the persistent scourge of gang violence affecting Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Meanwhile, the Mexican government interrupted the usually free-flowing traffic across the Suquiat River between Guatemala and Mexico, infuriating merchants on both sides. In recent years, as migrant caravans arrived in Tucanumán, Mexican troops lined the Mexican side of the Suquiat and largely stopped the raft traffic. This time, there is no large migrant presence across the river, but Mexico is again under pressure to slow the flow of migrants north as the U.S. government wrestles with the growing numbers on its border. Pentagon chief speaks of end to war in Afghanistan, filed by the Associated Press, begins with a photograph of U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin as he walks on the red carpet with acting Afghan Minister of Defense Yasin Zia as they review an honor guard at the Presidential Palace Sunday in Kabul, Afghanistan. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, on his first visit to Afghanistan as Pentagon chief, said Sunday that the Biden administration wants to see, quote, a responsible end to America's longest war, but the level of violence must decrease for fruitful diplomacy to have a chance. With questions swirling about how long U.S. troops will remain in the country, Austin said that in terms of an end date, or setting a specific date for withdrawal, that's the domain of my boss. He said his stop in Kabul, the capital, where he met with military commanders and senior Afghan government officials, including President Ashraf Ghani, was intended to let him listen and learn and inform my participation in reviewing the future of the American force. President Joe Biden said last week in an ABC News interview that it will be tough for the U.S. to meet a May 1st deadline to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. But Biden said that if the Taliban is extended, it wouldn't be a lot longer. Austin, who arrived after a visit to India, said, quote, there's always going to be concerns about things one way or the other, but I think there's a lot of energy focused on, you know, doing what's necessary to bring about a responsible end, a negotiated settlement to the war, unquote. The Taliban on Friday warned of consequences if the United States doesn't meet the deadline. Suhail Shaheen, a member of the Taliban negotiating team, told reporters that if American troops were to stay beyond May 1st, quote, it will be a kind of violation of the agreement. That agreement would not be from our side. Their violation will have a reaction. A statement released by the Presidential Palace on the Ghani-Austin meeting said both sides condemned the increase in violence in Afghanistan. There was no mention of the May 1st deadline. Washington is reviewing the agreement the Trump administration signed with the Taliban last year and has been stepping up pressure on both sides in the protracted conflict to find a swift route to a peaceful agreement. Quote, it's obvious that the level of violence remains pretty high in the country, Austin said. We'd really like to see that violence come down, and I think if it does come down, we can begin to set the conditions for, you know, some really fruitful diplomatic work, unquote. In a sharply worded letter to Ghani earlier this month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it was urgent to make peace in Afghanistan and that all options remained on the table. He also warned that it was likely the Taliban would make swift territorial gains if U.S. and NATO troops withdrew. The United States spends about $4 billion a year to sustain Afghanistan's national security forces. The Taliban warned America against defying the May 1st deadline at a news conference in Moscow, the day after meeting with senior Afghan government negotiators and international observers to try to jumpstart the stalled peace process to end Afghanistan's decades of war. Washington has given the Taliban and the Afghan government an 8-page peace proposal, which both sides are reviewing. It calls for an interim peace government that would shepherd Afghanistan toward constitutional reform and election. Ghani has resisted an interim administration, causing his critics to accuse him of clinging to power. He says elections alone would be acceptable to bring a change of government. Both the U.S. and Kabul have called for a reduction in violence leading to a ceasefire. The Taliban say a ceasefire would be part of the peace negotiations. The insurgent movement has not attacked U.S. or NATO troops since signing the agreement. But U.S. military commanders and NATO leaders have argued that the Taliban have not lived up to their part of the peace agreement, which includes a reduction in violence and a separation from Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Austin said he was confident in the ability of General Austin Miller, the commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, to accomplish his mission, quote, with the resources he has, and to protect American troops. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said last month that the alliance, quote, will only leave when the time is right and when conditions have been met. Quote, the main issue is that Taliban has to reduce violence. Taliban has to negotiate in good faith, and Taliban has to stop supporting international terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, he said. Austin has said little on the record about the stalemate. After a virtual meeting of NATO defense ministers, Austin told reporters that, quote, our presence in Afghanistan is conditions-based, and Taliban has to meet their commitments, unquote. Austin's stop in Afghanistan was his first return to a U.S. war zone in the Middle East since taking the Pentagon post, but he spent a great deal of time in the region during his service as an Army commander. Austin, a retired four-star general, served in Afghanistan as commander of the 10th Mountain Division. From 2013 to 2016, he was the head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Afghanistan visit comes at the end of Austin's first overseas trip as secretary. After a stop in Hawaii, he went to Japan and South Korea, where he and Blinken met with their defense and foreign counterparts. Turning to the Cedar Valley page, a bigger purpose. Well Plus Bar Designs helps adoptive and foster families with wares. And it opens with a photograph showing Katie Farrell, owner of Well Plus Bar Design, and she's standing with her hand on a long table, which is displaying merchandise in her business in Hudson on Tuesday. There are mannequins displaying T-shirts, and we also have signs and other merchandise laid out on the table. This story is filed by Melody Parker. Hudson, one of the Well Plus Far Design's latest T-shirts, is honey yellow and screen-printed with a decorative bee and the word kind. A cornflower blue T-shirt sports the phrase, be a kind human. Katie Farrell practices what she preaches. She's kind. Farrell also is a warm-hearted, cheerful, and thoughtful woman whose apparel and gift company is devoted to helping adoptive and foster care families and orphan children. The Hudson-based Well Plus Far Designs sells apparel and gifts online at www.wellandfardesigns.com. including T-shirts, sweatshirts, insulated tumblers, cards, earrings, and engraved pencil sets. Her occasional shop at 326 4th Street is open one weekend a month. Every purchase benefits an adoptive family or an organization chosen each month, such as Cedar Valley Angels, which assists foster families, or Give Hope RV, providing respite for adoptive and foster families. Farrell's business, with a bigger purpose, began when she and her husband, Nolan, and their family embarked on their own adoption journey. Quote, it's a long and involved process, emotional and expensive. I started thinking about something I could do to help with our finances. I've always been creative, so I taught myself screen printing and got my degree from YouTube, Farrell said, laughing. She previously majored in physical education and health at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, and taught as an adjunct instructor. The entrepreneur started with screen printing scarves that sold like the proverbial hotcakes. That was the encouragement she needed to expand into designing and screen printing T-shirts. Her first Well Plus Far design was a vintage-looking panther that UNI fans loved. The business soon snowballed, she said. That was 8 years ago. It took 5.5 years to adopt and bring home their son, JC, from Haiti 2 years ago. He's now 6 and a kindergartner. It just was meant to be. The kids love each other. It was worth the fight to get him home, Farrell said. His siblings are Blake, 14, Brenna, 12, and Adrian, who turns 10 in April. Quote, as we went through the process, I saw other families struggling too. I felt the need to help them. It was no longer about me or us. It was about how can we bless other people? What can I do to help them? It tugged at my heartstrings. She started Well Plus Far Designs in a spare bedroom in the basement of her home. The business grew exponentially online through social media and word of mouth. Then Farrell began to receive wholesale orders. Quote, I remember thinking, am I that legit? I could see the impact we were beginning to make, Farrell recalled. The Farrells purchased a former insurance office building at 326 4th Street several years ago and converted it into her creative space. Getting out of the basement has allowed her to reclaim some personal and family time as well. Quote, I work from 8 to 5 weekdays, some nights, and usually my weekends are hectic filling orders. It's nice to have work be at work. We can leave it and go home to spend time with my family. When you're working at home, you always feel like you should be doing more, Farrell explained. Farrell transformed the front of the building into a brick-and-mortar shop and opened for her first weekend in July. Earlier this year, the space was remodeled for more merchandise displays. Quote, there is a loyalty from people who have found us and want to come in and support what we do. In addition to her apparel and accessories, the Well Plus Far Design shop features home items like candles, fragrance, melts, and tea towels made by other Iowa artisans. Farrell has created hundreds of designs and rotates what's available to keep the merchandise fresh. Recently, she started a brand rep program, sending each participant a new t-shirt design monthly to wear and talk about on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media platforms. Her goal for Well Plus Far is simple. Quote, the more successful we are, the more adoptive families we can help, unquote. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, March 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to the sports page. In college volleyball, UNI defeats Loyola in 5-set series opener. Story filed by Nick Petteros and begins with a photograph of Emily Holterhouse. Cedar Falls. Northern Iowa's volleyball has become accustomed to going the distance this spring. The Panthers outlasted Loyola Sunday afternoon by winning the odd-numbered sets during a victory inside the McLeod Center, 25-13, 23-25, 25-13, 21-25, and 15-6. This marked the 6th 5-set match this season for a UNI team that improved to 7-10 overall and 7-6 in the Missouri Valley Conference play. Loyola fell to 6-7 against MVC opponents. Emily Holterhouse paced the Panthers with a career-high 21 kills to go with 14 digs for a defense that held Loyola's attackers to .125 hitting. Inga Rotto and Kalisa Andorfer added 13 kills apiece as Panther center Taylor Alden distributed 45 assists and UNI finished with a .268 hitting average. Behind the service line, Kaylee Donner, Bailey Peterson, and Andorfer each recorded 3 aces. UNI closed a convincing opening set on an 11-1 run before Loyola won the final 3 points of set 2 to level the match. The Panthers again finished strong in set 3, winning 13 of the final 17 points. UNI led 19-15 in set 4 before Loyola rallied to extend the match. The Panthers refused to be denied during the decisive 5th set. Loyola generated just 1 point on its serve in the shortened frame, while UNI tallied 9 5th-set kills on .292 hitting. UNI and Loyola return to the McLeod Center Monday for a 5 p.m. series finale. Panthers seniors Kate Buzwitz, Caitlin C. Hess, and Taylor Hedges will be honored following the team's final home match of the season. In NCAA women's basketball, Iowa showcases depth during win over Central Michigan, filed by Steve Batterson, and begins with a photograph of two women on the basketball court, and the caption says, Iowa center Sharon Goodman grabs a rebound in front of Central Michigan guard Anika Weeks during the first half of Sunday's 87-72 Iowa victory inside the Alamodrome in San Antonio. San Antonio, Kate Martin, Tommy Twiwo, and McKenna Warnock demonstrated Sunday that Iowa isn't just a two-player team. The trio had their moments in lifting the Hawkeyes to an 87-72 victory over Central Michigan in an opening round game in the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament at the Alamodrome. Martin scored 13 of her points in the opening quarter. Tewu bunched all 7 of hers together in the second quarter. Warnock scored 11 consecutive points during the third quarter to help Iowa find separation after the Chippewas had pulled within 6 points. Caitlin Clark and Monica Cisano led the Hawkeyes with 23 points apiece, but contributions from throughout the lineup proved to be a difference-making element to Iowa's success. Quote, 4 players in double figures, that's what I enjoy, Iowa coach Lisa Bluder said. Having those extra weapons is so important. People can't just focus on those two. Iowa hopes to extend its balancing act into a second-round matchup on Tuesday against Kentucky, which moved to an 18-8 with a 71-63 win Sunday over Idaho State. Quote, I didn't think there were many nerves before the game. I was just anxious and excited to play, said Clark, one of 4 Hawkeye starters making their NCAA tourney debuts on Sunday. We came out, shot the ball well, got a win, and now we can enjoy the rest of the day. The Hawkeyes game tipped off the entire tournament, and Bluder believed the 11 a.m. start benefited a young Iowa team. Quote, we got up, had a pregame meal, and played a game. There wasn't any time for us to sit around and get nervous, Bluder said. Martin ended any chance of that. She hit 3 of 4 shots she took and was perfectly in 4 free throw attempts in the first quarter, helping Iowa work its way through an early 5-point deficit and into a 27-20 lead. Quote, Kate got us off to a great start, just what we needed, Bluder said. Taiwo helped Iowa build a pair of 16-point leads in the second quarter, and Warnock dominated in the third after the Chippewas had pulled within a 58-52 score on a Maddie Waters basket at the 4:26 mark. Warnock finished off her run of 11 straight for Iowa with a pair of free throws and a 3-point basket at 3:03 left in the quarter, which sent the Hawkeyes 19-9 on their way to a 65-52 lead after 3. The effort was part of a 13-point, 10-rebound game by Warnock, her third consecutive double-double. But to win its NCAA opener for the 5th time in Iowa's last 6 appearances, the Hawkeyes had to find a way to deal with Central Michigan's Michaela Kelly. Despite picking up 3 fouls in the first quarter, Kelly scored 14 of her 23 points in the opening half, even though she played just under 8 minutes. Quote, we knew it was going to have to be a team effort to guard her, Clark said. Everybody helped a bit, and the fouls made a difference, but it wasn't easy to slow her down. The Chippewas, 18-9, were a different team without their scoring and defensive leader. Iowa went on an 11-3 run when Kelly exited after picking up 2 fouls in the first 5 minutes of the game, turning a 13-8 deficit into a 19-16 lead that quickly brought Kelly back into the game. She got tangled up with Martin at midcourt and picked up her 3rd foul with 1:11 remaining in the opening quarter. By the time she returned with a 3:34 remaining in the second quarter, the Hawkeyes had opened a 42-26 advantage. Kelly scored 6 points in the final minute of the half, pulling Central Michigan within 48-37 at the break. Quote, she was a lot easier to guard when she was on the bench, Bluder said. We tried to get up higher on her in the second half, and we switched more so she couldn't get around the corner as easily and it made a difference. In NASCAR, Blaney wins at Atlanta as Larson can't keep pace, filed by Paul Newberry of the Associated Press. The story begins with a photograph showing the 12 passing the number 5, and we see in the background a sparsely populated grandstand. And the caption for the picture says, Ryan Blaney, 12, passes Kyle Larson on with 8 laps remaining on his way to victory in the NASCAR Cup Series race Sunday at Atlanta Motor Speedway in Hampton, Georgia. Ryan Blaney knew he had to let Kyle Larson go. Patience was a key, especially on a day when Larson looked unbeatable. In the end, Larson faded on a battered set of tires, and Blaney raced by him for an improbable victory on Sunday. Quote, it was not going to be able to stick with him, Blaney said. I've got to save my tires and see what happens. Blaney became the 6th driver to win in 6 races to start NASCAR's Cup season, surging to the front with 9 laps to go after Larson easily won the first 2 stages and led 269 of 325 laps on the 1.54-mile tri-oval. Larson's tires didn't stand up to the punishing track after making his final pit stop with 56 laps to go. Blaney stayed close enough to make his move, hugging the outside wall through the 4th turn and cutting into the inside to pass Larson as they crossed the line in front of the main grandstands. Blaney pulled away to win by 2.083 seconds in his number 12 Team Penske Ford, having gone just as long as Larson on the final set of tires, but getting much more out of them. Quote, it's cool to win at a place where you've got to finesse it a little bit and think about it, Blaney said after his 5th career victory. He led just 25 laps, but was out in front for the one that mattered. When it was over, Blaney strolled over to the stands and grabbed the checkered flag, which he handed to a young fan wearing the driver's T-shirt. It was a bitter loss for Larson, who missed a chance to become 2021's first 2-time winner after a victory at Las Vegas 2 weeks ago. Still, he is off to a strong start in his new job at Hendrick Motorsports, less than a year after blurting out a racial slur on the live stream of a late-night video racing game, which cost him his job at Chip Ganassi Racing. Quote, I hate to lead a lot of laps and lose, Larson said. The car was stupid fast for a long time there. The Cup Series returned to the track where the racing world came to a halt a year ago. In March 2020, Atlanta was the first NASCAR Cup race to be postponed because of the coronavirus pandemic. This time, the race went off as scheduled before a socially distanced crowd of about 20,000, far below capacity because of the lingering COVID-19 outbreak, but a welcome change from last June when no fans were allowed for Atlanta's makeup race. The Cup Series will be back July 11th, the first time since 2010 that Atlanta has hosted 2 races in a season. Who's hot? Pole sitter Denny Hamlin continues to lead the season standings after another strong run. He was 4th behind Blaney, Larson, and Alex Bowman. Hamlin has finished in the top 5 in every race but Homestead, where he was 11th. Still, he's clearly perturbed about failing to take the top spot. Quote, we're just not fast enough, Hamlin said. We need more speed. Who's not? Stewart Haas Racing is off to a tough start in 2021. Kevin Harvick, who had won 2 of the last 3 races in Atlanta, was never in a mix after having to make an extra pit stop early on to change a flat that resulted from a broken tire stem. He did battle back to a 10th place finish. The other Stewart Haas drivers were even farther back. Cole Custer, 18th, Eric Almirola, 20th, and Chase Briscoe, 23rd. None has cracked the top 10 this season. Kurt Busch had the look of a contender until the restart to begin the 2nd stage. As the cars stacked up behind Larson, Busch got bumped from behind by Hamlin and slammed into the outside wall going into turn 1, sustaining heavy damage that ended the number 1 Chevy's day. Busch conceded that Hamlin didn't do anything vicious or malicious, but he was still ticked off. These are the days that hurt the worst, said Busch, who finished last in the 39-car field. It's a restart. Where are we going to go, man? Just chill. It was also a tough day for defending Cup champion and home state favorite Chase Elliott. Scheduled to start from the fifth position, he had to take the green from the back of the field after failing multiple inspections before the race. Then, shortly after a restart to begin the final stage, Elliott's number 7 Chevy blew the engine coming off turn 4. The car was pushed to the paddock with a 38th place finish. Up next, the series heads to Bristol Motor Speedway next Sunday for the highly anticipated dirt race on the half-mile oval. It will be the first dirt race for NASCAR's top racers since 1970, 2 years before a revamp of the series led to what is known as the Modern Cup era. Now in college softball, UNI salvages win over Missouri State, filed by Nick Petteros, Springfield, Missouri. Darren Lamprecht doubled down the first go-ahead run in the sixth inning Sunday afternoon as Northern Iowa secured a 7-6 Missouri Valley Conference softball victory at Missouri State. UNI, 10-12, bounced back after being swept by Missouri State, 11-9, in Saturday's series opening doubleheader. The Panthers strung together 9 hits with Lamprecht, Emily Wells, and Faith Standreski, each recording 2-hit games. A 2-run double by Cameron Schaefer capped a 4-run fifth inning that gave UNI a 6-3 advantage before Missouri State tied the game on Alex Bose's 2-run homer in the bottom of the fifth. Panther ace Kalen Packard pitched the final 2 2/3 innings of a scoreless relief to improve her record to 7-3. In college soccer, UNI dominates Southern Illinois, filed by Nick Petteros, and begins with a photograph of Ashley Harrington, Carbondale, Illinois. Northern Iowa's offense clicked Sunday afternoon during a dominant 5-0 Missouri Valley Conference women's soccer victory at Southern Illinois. A UNI team, 2-2-2, that scored 1 goal in its previous 5 contests, bombarded the Sulkies 0-3-3 with 13 shots on goal throughout the match. UNI's Ashley Harrington and Allison Whitaker opened scoring in the 14th and 15th minutes. Sophia Conant then found the net in the 32nd minute for a 3-0 halftime lead. Lauren Heinz added a second half goal for the Panthers, and Harrington assisted Sandra Timon for the final tally. While UNI's offense consistently found finishing touches, the Panther defense also excelled. UNI allowed just 1 shot en route to its 4th shutout of the season. Quote, "I was really impressed with our attitude in today's game," UNI head coach Bruce Erickson said. "We played confident, and we got rewarded for finishing some great chances while also defending well and getting another shutout," unquote. In men's NCAA tournament results, Loyola Chicago stuns top-seeded Illinois. Indianapolis. Loyola Chicago carried out 101-year-old superfan Sister Jean's plans to a T on Sunday, moving to the Sweet 16 with a 71-58 win over Illinois, the first number 1 seed bounced from this year's NCAA tournament. Aaron Krutwig delivered a 19-point, 12-rebound masterpiece, and the 8th-seeded Ramblers, 26-4, led wire-to-wire. They befuddled a powerful Illinois offense to return the second weekend 3 years after the first magical run to the Final Four. Loyola's 2018 trip to the Final Four was headlined by Sister Jean Dolores Smith, the venerable team chaplain who received both COVID-19 vaccination shots and clearance to travel to Indianapolis to see what inspiration she could provide in 2021. Jean delivered a pregame prayer that could have been stripped straight from the John Wooden handbook. Illinois, 24-7, earned top seeding for the first time since its own Final Four run in 2005, but fell behind by double digits in the first half and never got within striking range. The Illini committed 16 turnovers and scored 23 points fewer than their season average. Illinois 7-foot second-team All-American Kofi Cockburn finished with 21 points on 7-for-12 shooting, but Loyola's guards Lucas Williamson and Keith Clemens limited first-team All-American Ayo Dosunmu to 9 points, 11 under his season average. Scores for the other games in the series in the Midwest region: number 2 Houston, 63, number 10 Rutgers, 60, number 11 Syracuse, 75, number 3 West Virginia, 72. In the South region: number 1 Baylor, 76, number 9 Wisconsin, 63, number 3 Arkansas, 68, number 6 Texas Tech, 66, number 15 ORU, 81, and number 7 Florida, 78. Let's pick up some more local news now. Turning back to the Cedar Valley page, there is the Call the Courier column. Question: are they planning on having a Bacon Fest this year? Answer: a call to the organizers of previous Cedar Valley Bacon Fests said the event is no longer taking place. Question: are they going to have Irish Fest this year? Answer: Iowa Irish Fest is a go for 2021, event organizers announced last week. The festival will take place August 6th through the 8th in and around the newly renovated Lincoln Park area of downtown Waterloo. The 2020 event went viral because of COVID-19. Question: how many presidents have we had that were both father and son? Who were they? Answer: there have been two father-son presidential combinations: John Adams, the second U.S. president, and son John Quincy Adams, the sixth president, and George H.W. Bush, 41st president, and George W. Bush, the 43rd. Question: do I need the star on my driver's license to travel within the United States? Answer: according to the TSA, beginning October 1st, every traveler will need to present a real ID-compliant license or an acceptable form of identification to fly within the United States. Question: if you owe federal income tax from past years, will you still get a stimulus check? Answer: according to several sources, stimulus money is meant to boost the economy and give a lifeline to those in need. So the IRS will still send you a check, even if you're behind on your tax bills. Question: if a store has a sign that says masks required and a person doesn't wear one, can the store legally tell the person to leave? Answer: in most cases, yes. According to Business Insider, absent a claim of discrimination, stores can eject maskless customers just as they can enforce no shirt, no shoes, no service edicts. Question: does the Johnson & Johnson vaccine have aborted fetal cells in it? Answer: no. COVID-19 vaccines do not contain any aborted fetal cells. All three currently approved vaccines did testing using fetal cell lines, and Johnson & Johnson uses fetal cell lines in vaccine development, confirmation, and production. But fetal cell lines are not the same as fetal tissue. Fetal cell lines are grown in laboratory, descended from cells taken from elective abortions in the 1970s and 1980s. Current fetal cell lines are thousands of generations removed from the original fetal tissue. They do not contain any tissue from a fetus. Hinson explains vote against immigration bills and rails on Rita Hart challenge. Story filed by Amy Rivers, Washington, D.C. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson voted against two bills that passed the House of Representatives on Thursday that would establish a path to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants, including Dreamers, brought to the country as children and agricultural workers. Unlike other Republicans who have noted a surge in migrants in February, Hinson faulted President Joe Biden's executive orders that she said have, quote, incentivized and increased illegal immigration. Quote, there's 100,000 immigrants that crossed the border in February alone, Hinson said on her weekly call with reporters Friday, citing figures from U.S. Customs and Border Protection that show immigration on the Mexican border is on the rise. Quote, we need to be focusing on legal immigration right now. There are too many amnesty provisions in these bills. 9 Republicans voted with Democrats on the American Dream and Promise Act that would provide a path to citizenship for Dreamers, and 30 Republicans joined the most Democrats on the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which would permit some ag workers to gain a green card if they pay a fine and keep working in the industry for several more years. Hinson was not among them. Quote, I would be happy to look at a path for citizenship for children who are brought here through no fault of their own, but this bill specifically went too far, beyond amnesty to dreamers, she said. The bills will need all Democrats and 10 Republican votes in the Senate to pass. Hinson also excoriated a House review of an election challenge by Rita Hart, a Democrat who lost a House election to the current U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks by just 6 votes. The election was certified in Iowa in November, but Hart has challenged that, saying 22 ballots were legally cast in the district but not counted, which would give her a 9-vote win. A House panel is considering the challenge. Quote, the votes here were counted, recounted, and then certified, Hinson said. Miller Meeks is a duly elected member of Congress, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is moving closer to overturning the election. Quote, I know Iowans are outraged by this, Hinson continued. Quote, how are people supposed to trust their votes and know their votes count if the majority party can overturn an election in their favor? Lawyers for both Hart and Miller Meeks have until Monday to send their initial briefs to the panel, which voted on party lines to consider the case last week. Despite doubters, progress on Waverly Park. Contract approved to build new shelter at South Riverside Park. Amy Rivers filed this story. Waverly. Progress is being made on a new shelter in a park along the Cedar River, despite what some members of a private Facebook group may think, city commissioners said during their meeting Thursday. Garrett Riordan, Leisure Services Director for Waverly, noted the city council approved a $363,000 contract with Cardinal Construction of Waterloo to construct a new shelter at South Riverside Park, located at 319 First Street Southwest. The original shelter was built in 1970. Work is slated to begin on the new shelter between April and May, and Riordan said he hopes it'll be done by June. Quote, there was a rumor there might be some trouble getting the steel we needed to use for it, he told Leisure Services Commission. Quote, if that's the case, we'll cut them a little slack. It'll get it done. Chair Joel Johnson noted replacing the shelter, as well as renovating the exchange building on site, was a 2-year process. The shelter's progress was interrupted by bids that came in over budget, as well as for the coronavirus pandemic. Riordan noted the commission will start taking bids soon on construction on a plaza to go around the new shelter and exchange building. He said it's also possible the north parking lot may be taken out, but that discussion will come later. Quote, now, this spring, this summer, you'll see the activity down there. Things will start to improve, Johnson said. I think overall, the citizens are going to be happy with the way it's going to turn out, unquote. New commission member Angie Brunson said that wasn't how Waverly citizens were talking about the projects on a private Facebook group, Waverly, Iowa Online Town Hall. The group has over 1,000 members. Quote, there's kind of a lot of people that are like, oh my God, that's a lot of money that we're spending. I could build a shelter for half the price of what the bids are, Brunson said. Quote, welcome to Leisure Services, Johnson said wryly. Wyrden said he avoids the page, and other commissioners agreed, including Liaison and Ward 1 Councilman Brian Bergen. I think it's very helpful to have face-to-face conversations with people rather than try to get into Facebook debates, Bergen said. He added the people who have reached out to him had, quote, a lot of incorrect pieces of information, including that the exchange building had not yet been renovated and that phases of the shelter project had been skipped. Commissioner Derek Solheim advised Brunson that if she decided to weigh in on the discussions, to steer people to Riordan to have their questions answered. The challenge is, as a commissioner, to not take a side, but be able to guide them to the facts, Solheim said. And lastly, we have an editorial filed by Aaron Murphy. Partly cloudy skies in Iowa during Sunshine Week. Last week was Sunshine Week, the annual reminder about the critical importance of open and transparent governance. With that in mind, let's discuss a couple of examples in Iowa where some clouds are blocking some of that disinfecting sunshine. Governor Kim Reynolds' administration could be more expedient in responding to journalists' open records requests. You can believe me when I say that I am not alone in offering this analysis. That sound you just heard was the entire Statehouse Press Corps shouting, "Hallelujah!" Many open records requests are still waiting on a response months after they were originally filed. To be fair to Reynolds and her staff, they have said they were inundated with public records requests during the COVID-19 pandemic, which was already stressing their workloads. That may be fair, and it's certainly believable. Media organizations have been unyielding in monitoring how state governments have managed pandemic response efforts. I have no reason to doubt the governor's staff when they say they have been overwhelmed by open records requests. Heavy is the head, however, and part of governing is being responsive to the public. That includes making records available to the public. And it is incumbent upon all levels of government to be reasonably nimble in responding to such requests. Unfortunately, Iowa law provides some wiggle room for how long a government body has to respond to an open record request. The Iowa Public Information Board, a state board established to oversee open records and meeting laws, notes a 2005 advisory opinion from the state attorney general that said, quote, "Delay is never justified simply for the convenience of the governmental body, but delay will not violate the law if it is in good faith or reasonable." The board also offers some best practices for responding to open records requests, and one of them is for the records custodians to work diligently to retrieve and release the records, unquote. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, March 22nd. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may want to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.